You're listening to the Rescuer MBS podcast with hosts Laura McGladrey and Marcel Rodriguez. For show notes and additional information, visit www.anchor.fm/rescuer-mbs or visit our Facebook page, Rescuer MBS Podcast. Rescuer MBS, know your limits, improve your performance. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rescuer MBS Podcast. I'm your host, Marcel Rodriguez, flying solo on this episode to bring you discussion on psychological first aid. But first, we'd like to start out with a little bit of gratitude, express that to all of you out there, our listeners. We've now, last check, have listeners in 24 countries around the world, which is both really super exciting and a bit surprising. But it's really exciting to see how that message is growing and how it's resonating around the world. Also, a very big shout out to Peter Frick-Wright and the Outside Podcast for bringing our interview that we did with Peter and having that on the Outside Podcast. Clearly helped to bring our podcast to the attention of a much wider audience, and because of that is responsible in a great sense for our increased listenership. So thank you to you as well. And on the topic of gratitude, this is an interesting sort of topic that, before we get started, just maybe spend a little bit of time on. Gratitude is a really great thing to be building into your daily practice. There's a lot of research around a field called positive psychology that looks at things like gratitude and positive outlook and how that can change the way we think. And there is a specific set of research done by two psychologists from University of California, Davis and University of Miami, where they just simply asked people to write things that they were grateful for each week. So a few sentences on what they're grateful for. And what they found is that after 10 weeks, they had people who were writing things they were grateful for, people who were writing things that irritated them, and then people, a third group, who wrote about things that had no real effect on them, positive or negative. And what they found is after 10 weeks, those who wrote about the gratitude were more optimistic, felt better in their lives, exercised more, fewer visits to the doctor, just a bunch of different things that helped change their outlook. And it may sound a little hokey, but I know personally I build gratitude into my daily practice. Very simply, you can do things like on a daily basis, write three things down that you're grateful for and just maybe reflect on them for a few moments. And what you'll find is that sometimes that is something that can help to change a negative mindset or to keep you in a more positive mindset. And again, it sounds like it's maybe way too simple, but I think one of the things that it points out is that we really don't reflect very much on gratitude and the things that we're grateful for. If you are interested in that, in more details on that, I'm putting a link into both our show notes and also onto our Facebook page, Rescuer MBS Podcast, so that you can see the article that I'm referencing from Harvard Health and see more details on that study and other studies. So the primary topic of today's episode is psychological first aid, and this is based on a presentation that I gave at the 2019 International Technical Rescue Symposium. And so there is a PowerPoint that goes along with this, and so if you'd like to follow along at home, or if you just want to reference some of the things that I'll be talking about later, I will include a link in the show notes, as well as, again, on our Facebook page, Rescuer MBS Podcast. So when we think about psychological first aid, oftentimes this is viewed as something that we're doing to other people. It's an external thing, and that really is primarily the focus of psychological first aid. So it's a set of techniques that we can use with our patients or with our subjects, and we'll talk about kind of the discussion of what patient is, because I think it's broader than a lot of times what we think about. But these are also things that what I would suggest is that it makes sense to look at psychological first aid, just not in the context of our subjects, but also to look at it for our teammates, our friends, family. And as we saw in the, if you heard the interview with Peter Frick-Wright, we can even apply them to ourselves to help with us with stressful situations. And when we talk about psychological first aid, if you're wondering, like, what does that actually mean? You know, what it is an evidence-formed modular approach to help in the immediate aftermath of a traumatic event. It helps us process those events. And our primary goals with administering PFA are to reduce the initial distress that we have with an incident, to mitigate the impacts of stress injuries, to look at those stress injuries in their formation and try to disrupt that cycle, and to help individuals begin to process the event. Individuals, you know, again, meaning ourselves, you know, our teammates, and specifically our subjects. One of the things that's really important to remember, and I think we talked about this in previous episodes, is that stress injuries are physical injuries. If we leave a stress injury or if we don't really address a stress injury, we will end up with physical manifestations of those injuries. And this is kind of one of the big premises of this podcast, which is that those stress injuries over time will then end up in things that impact us as individuals, and we'll start to see those in things like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and a lot of different nasty things that shorten our lifespan. And so if you think about a stress injury as a physical injury, psychological first aid is the treatment that we provide for subjects that may be in danger for stress injuries. So this isn't some sort of add-on that we do or some nice to have. This is, you know, if we're looking at it, this is the treatment that we provide. So when there's a potential for a stress injury, we should be applying psychological first aid. You know, if you think about it in a corollary, you know, if we have a wound that we treat well, we can help to avoid the infection, we can help to minimize or eliminate scar formation. You know, so those normal things that we would take for a wound are the same type of things that we want to do with psychological first aid. If we apply it right at the right time, we can lessen the formation of stress injuries. And so if we look at that concept of how stress injuries are developed, if we can look at an event or an incident kind of on a timeline, and you look and you see how do we come to that incident? So when you come to it, we have our mindset, we have our stress, we have previous injuries, the things that we walk into it with, how are we ready to accept a stressful incident? We also have our history, we have our experiences, we have what I call our demonstrated ability to suffer. And that's just kind of that whole history of how we can deal with injuries. And if you think about oftentimes during when we have a missing subject, we look at things, you know, we want to know what their experience is. Have they been lost before? How did they react to that? You know, are they a hunter? Are they a camper or backpacker? Do they have military experience? All those things kind of go together to help us form a picture of potentially how they might react. But those things also can be positives or negatives prior to an incident. So we go into that with those. We have an incident that happens. And then there's a period from that incident until the rescuers get there, this kind of pre-rescue period. And during that period, depending upon the type of injury and how people might view their chances for survival, their chances for rescue, we have this whole series of things that come about. So, you know, we can have doubt, we can have fear, we have a loss of agency or control, we have guilt, pain, all these different things that happen. And while we're going through that, we're in this fight or flight mechanism where, you know, we've got cortisol injecting into our system and lots of, you know, spinning up. And it ends up in a state where it can be into hyper arousal. We can find people that kind of do just the opposite and freeze up. We can find people getting into a level of despair because of that. And then at some point, the rescuers come and, you know, here we arrive, boom, 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 and, you know, life is grand. And if we, from that, when the rescuers get there to the time that the subjects are in a safe, warm, happy place, can be a fairly substantial period of time. I know from my own experience in our area, when we reach a patient, we may be, you know, we may be several hours from getting them to a point where we get them to ambulance or to definitive care. And so that may be a very extended period. And one thing that we, when we look at that period between when we get there and when they are at that definitive care or when they're at a point where that, you know, where they can feel safe, you know, the question that we have to ask ourselves is when does the incident end for them? You know, and when does that processing begin? And depending on how we approach this, we can either have it be right as soon as we get there, we can start to end that incident for them, plant the flag, and kind of give them an all clear message, which is really what our body's looking for. Our body's looking for to get out of this state of hyperarousal or freeze or despair. What we're looking for is we're looking for something to give the all clear message. And, you know, that's a big part of what we can be doing as rescuers. A lot of times what we see and what I've experienced, and I think we see as we talk to other people, is that we focus very much on the rescue, and we focus on a lot of times treatment of a patient, you know, medical treatment of a patient, where we're working, you know, I would say a technical medical approach, where we're approaching their wounds, we're dealing with the logistical problem of moving them from where they're at, and we're not as focused on the actual individual themselves. And that's really the switch that we're looking at as we approach with psychological first aid. And psychological first aid, when we look at it, really consists of five different elements. And they are safety, calming, self-efficacy, connection, and hope. Let's go through each of those in turn and see what they mean and how to approach them. So if we start with safety, what we want to do is establish a sense of safety. And that really helps to ground the individual and begins to end the event. And, you know, sometimes this is as simple as, you know, I call it planting the flag. And this is what we really want to do, is to kind of say, you know, we're here, you're safe. And sometimes it just takes declarative statements about safety and security, where we say, you know, positive statements emphasizing safety, ensuring that we can do things that make them feel safe. Maybe that's if someone's like literally grounding people, having them sit down, having them be in touch with the ground and feeling safe in that sense. We can also protect them from additional stresses. So part of that is things like ensuring that we're turning down radios and protecting them from language that they might be disturbing. You know, we want to provide them with information if we can to reduce their anxiety. But really the whole thing is really to make the individual feel that they are safe, and that whatever they've been through, we're here now, we're all in this together, we're gonna, you know, you're safe. And it sounds, again, sounds kind of hokey, but if you think about the mindset that someone has when they're coming into these, when they've been through something like this, just being able to have somebody say, this is it, we're safe, you know, that's a big step for them. Next up, we'll look at calm. So part of this is, if you think about it, we're in a very high stress situation. Someone's been, you know, they've been in this hyperarousal. And what we want to do is we really want to calm them down. And this is kind of part of that whole thing of, we can't really process when we're in hyperarousal, but we can start to process when we calm down. So part of this, as it would make sense, is we create calm by calming ourselves and our team first. We can't tell somebody else to calm down if we're hyper aroused ourselves. And sometimes that's a little difficult as we go into a situation. Depending on how it's, you know, how we've approached this situation, when we get to a subject, oftentimes we're pretty spun up ourselves. And just taking that second to take a couple breaths, calm yourself down, and model that calm behavior as we deal with them. Again, turning down radios, you know, making sure that our voices are calm, telegraphing the calm in our actions and our words, emphasizing the present, the practical, and the possible. So what can we do to really, again, ground them into this situation and give them reason for calm? And again, reducing all that input that counters the calm. So the people yelling back and forth with things talking about somebody, or radio traffic that is just disturbing. So those kind of things. You know, one of the things that I always joke around about is hot drinks and pudding cups. And what I mean by that is that we like to, when we have a subject that, especially someone who's not severely injured, but has been out there for a while and is very excited about things, or very anxious about things, is what we like to do is pretty quickly, if we can, start a fire, get some hot drinks going. And really that it's all about that calm. And the calm is, or the messaging really is, how bad can it be if we're drinking cocoa, eating chocolate, sitting by the fire, whatever your thing that you can do is, but something that kind of demonstrates calm. And one of the rituals that we have on my own team is that at the end of a mission, we try to, for the rescuers, our all clear signal is a pudding cup. So everybody kind of gathers around for the debrief. We pass around pudding cups, and that's really just a ritualistic message that says, okay, all clear, mission accomplished, and creates that sense of calm. When we look at self-efficacy is all about returning a sense of agency and inclusion to an individual. And if you look and you say, if you look at how these situations occur, as someone's been through a situation where they've gotten lost, they've gotten injured, or they've witnessed something, oftentimes they feel that they don't have agency over that situation, or their agency has been taken from them. And so they don't have control over the decisions that are being made, or they don't have control over what's happened to them. And so a lot of what we try to do is to return that to them, to help them process. And if you think about oftentimes how we approach a subject when we've got them, a lot of times we kind of do things to them. And by that, what I mean is that we look at them as being someone that we have to care for as far as medically, someone that we have to logistically move from place to place, but we don't really view them oftentimes as part of that rescue. And this is really a pretty important part of stopping their event from happening, which is instead of continuing it to happen to them, to make them part of the team that's getting out of that. And sometimes this can be as simple, again, as things like, we're all going to get out of this together. We're working together to rectify the situation, but really bringing the subject onto the team as opposed to talking over them or talking about them. We want to, if we can, engage them in their own rescue. I think Peter Frick Wright said this really well about how nobody had asked him, you know, what was his plans on getting out of things. And so this is that point where what were they intending? You know, did they, if they know the area, can we get some information from them? Or can we just give them a task that helps them come onto the team? And this can be as simple as we're taking a pulse and we just give them a number. Hey, can you remember 98? Great pulse. Can you just remember this number? Even if we're writing it down, even if we know we don't need them to do that number, it's just something to bring them into the team and into that planning. And we want to make sure that the subject, as much as possible, is part of the planning, part of the treatment that we're talking to and we're working with, and just making sure that they, if we can, give them that sense of agency, give them that sense of inclusion. As we then move into connection, you know, one of the big things that we know about stress injuries are more likely to form when we feel isolation. And if we think about that connection that we can make to others, that helps interrupt that cycle. So if you think while someone is experiencing an incident and they're feeling isolated, hyper-aroused, potentially feeling that they may not make it out of there and are feeling isolated and alone, we counter that by creating a connection with them. And some of them are pretty simple. Be with your subject. And I mean, really be with them. So connect with them if you can. Use their name. If you can, talk to them. Talk to them. Make sure that they understand who's on the team and who's around them. We don't want to talk over them or about them. We want to build as much as we can an on-scene relationship with our subjects. And if possible, if we can allow contact with friends or family, loved ones, pets, whatever it is that's possible, that we can connect them to them to, again, ground them, connect them, and provide those senses of safety and calm. And interestingly, I think this is the one that rescuers often have the most difficulty with. We understand how to interact with our subjects often with as a technical problem, moving them from one place to another. We understand how to deal with their medical issues, but we don't spend a lot of time on how to really connect with somebody who's in a tough situation. And that's it's one of those skill sets that, you know, can be very, very helpful and really can make the difference. Just making that connection. I think, again, if anybody, for those who've listened to the interview with Peter Frick Wright, the connection part of that is what really stuck out to him, and what really, I think, when you look at what he credits as kind of the things that had the most effect, that that was one of them. And I think that that's really what we're shooting for, is we're really looking at if we can make that connection with our subjects, it can really help us in helping them counter that isolation, stop the formation of those stress injuries, and give them that all clear message that we're looking to give them. And finally, we have hope. And hope is this thing that thickens that line between the seen and survival. We don't want to give platitudes to people. We don't want to tell them things that aren't true to make them feel better. What we want to do is we want to do things like reflecting specific, accurate, positive facts to them and talk about predictable, realistic steps. So we can tell them the things that we know. We can emphasize, especially with teams, the amount of experience on a team, the regularity with which we do something. Things that may seem, for us, fairly routine can be extremely discomforting to someone who's never been through it before. And the fact that we view this as a very simple pack out or as a not so terrible event, that may not necessarily be how the subject is viewing it. And so part of it is just giving them that hope, even in situations where we think it might not be all that necessary. We can emphasize the strengths of the situation, and we can encourage the subject to talk about the future, and just creating a picture for them of the future and of the situation that says, this isn't hopeless, we're all here together, and we're going to get out of this. And I think one of the things that's really important is to recognize that none of the elements of psychological first aid require a great deal of technical skill. They're all elements of basic human interaction and compassion. And as rescuers, again, our training tends to focus on the technical and the systematic and much less on the emotional and the human aspects. And I would also like, emphasize again that psychological first aid is as much a part of good, complete patient care and team dynamics as any technical skill that we're learning. And the effects of not doing it can have really significant consequences into the future for our subjects and for ourselves. One of the other things I think that's important, again, is as I talked about in the beginning, is that it's important for us to look at our concept of who the subject is in a much broader context than we may often be looking at it. An often overlooked category of individuals that may be impacted are the witnesses or the friends or the partners or the people that were out with somebody who we would view as our primary patient. So going through a scenario where you maybe aren't the person that's injured, but you were there witnessing and going through this can be just as devastating to that individual as the person who's been injured. And oftentimes I think we look at those people who are the reporting parties or the partners or the witnesses as they're doing fine. Maybe we talk to them briefly, but we don't spend a lot of time with them. And I think what we've seen is that those are the people that carry some of these things with them long after an event. And so it's really important that as rescuers, we look at them and say, do we need to provide psychological first aid to them as well? And again, this also will apply to our teammates and ourselves if we can, to help us recognize that when we get into these situations, we can go through these things and we can calm ourselves, we can give ourselves self-efficacy, making connection, looking for hope, and getting that sense of safety. But again, broadening out that view of just, it's not just the person who's bleeding or broken or lying in a heap that we're dealing with, it's kind of everybody in that realm and around that scene that we need to look at and say, is this someone that we need to look at? And when we get through this, this isn't just kind of one of these things where psychological first aid is applied once and we go through all these steps. These are things that we kind of, it's the wash, rinse, repeat. We apply them constantly throughout a rescue, and we look and see, do we need to reemphasize something? Do we need to, as things pop up, do we need to address one of these elements in a different way? And so if we look back to our initial question, when we go through that incident and we look and we say, when does the incident end? When does the processing begin? I view it as our role as rescuers is we should start to you know, we should seek to end that incident as soon as we arrive. We should seek to plant that flag and help to give that all clear message to our subjects and to the people that are around us so that they can begin to process that incident as quickly as possible and not have it be something that extends on beyond our arrival and goes through the entirety of their rescue and beyond. And I think that's really should be our primary goal with psychological first aid. So that was a really quick run through on the elements of psychological first aid and how we can apply them. We'll be talking about this in greater detail in future episodes, as well as looking at different aspects of psychological first aid, stress injuries, and a lot of other topics. Thank you once again for your continued support, and we hope that you're taking the time to care for yourself, care for your teammates, and care for those around you. This has been the Rescuer MBS podcast. Please subscribe to receive new episodes and interviews as they come out. Contact us at rescuermbs@gmail.com. Rescuer MBS, know your limits, improve your performance.